The Guardian.
This podcast is sponsored by audible.co.uk, the number one online destination for digital audiobooks.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
We're coming in! Hello? Anybody home?
I think I like the office better.
This is nothing.
No! Get out! Get out!
All right, freeze, lady. Stay down.
You get out of my house! Don't you dare take my family away from you. Get out!
Check out the rest of the house. There could be a child in here.
She's very, very beautiful. She's making a remake of Gaslight, a thriller movie. And she is found brutally murdered.
He doesn't want us to cut through our chains.
No!
He wants us to cut through our feet.
He helped me. To my daughter, Linda Mary Stevens, I leave my entire inheritance, all goods, chattels, and worldly possessions.
You can't go outside, they'll tear you apart.
Raybeth loves me.
Claire. I trust her.
I don't trust anything that bleeds for 5 days and doesn't die.
No. Someone murdered him. Someone made him dead. Came from downstairs.
There will be blood.
I can't see a freaking thing. Turn on the light.
Visitors to last summer's Edinburgh Festival found it overrun by the undead. Zombies were everywhere, fictionally speaking, of course. Well, we saw them off, only to find ourselves under siege 9 months later by the new season's scary monsters. We have two of them on this podcast, a time-travelling serial killer and a child abductor who feasts on human souls. So be afraid, be very afraid. One of the features of these new monsters is that they're not always where you expect them to be. The boundaries are breaking down, letting horror loose where you least expect it. Lauren Bucus, the South African writer, has made a name for herself as one of the rising stars of the science fiction universe. Her last novel, Zoo Story, won a prestigious Arthur C. Clarke Award. But her latest, The Shining Girls, has only one SF element in what is primarily a killer thriller. Close your eyes now and brace yourself while Lauren reads a passage to Alison Flood.
Harper, 17 July, 1974. He clenches the orange plastic pony in the pocket of his sports coat. It is sweaty in his hand. Midsummer here, too hot for what he's wearing. But he has learned to put on a uniform for this purpose, jeans in particular. He takes long strides, a man who walks because he's got somewhere to be, despite his gimpy foot. Harper Curtis is not a moocher, and time waits for no one, except when it does. The girl is sitting cross-legged on the ground, her bare knees white and bony as bird skulls and grass-stained. She looks up at the sound of his boots scrunching on the gravel, but only long enough for him to see that her eyes are brown under that tangle of grubby curls, before she dismisses him and goes back to her business. Harper is disappointed. He had imagined, as he approached, that they might be blue, the color of the lake deep out where the shoreline disappears and it feels like you're in the middle of the ocean. Brown is the color of shrimping, where the mud is all churned up in the shallows and you can't see shit for shit. "What are you doing?" he says, putting brightness in his voice. He crouches down beside her in the threadbare grass. Really, he's never seen a child with such crazy hair. Like she got spun around in her own personal dust devil, one that tossed up the assortment of random junk splayed around her. A cluster of rusty tin cans, a broken bicycle wheel tipped on its side, spokes jabbing outwards. Her attention is focused on a chipped teacup, turned upside down, so that the silvered flowers on the lip disappear into the grass. The handle has broken off, leaving two blunt stumps. "You having a tea party, sweetheart?" he tries again. "It's not a tea party," she mutters into the petal-shaped collar of her checked shirt. Kids with freckles shouldn't be so earnest, he thinks. It doesn't suit them. Well, that's fine, he says. I prefer coffee anyways. May I have a cup, please, ma'am? Black with 3 sugars, okay? He reaches for the chipped porcelain, and the girl yelps and bats his hand away. A deep, angry buzzing comes from underneath the inverted cup. Jesus, what do you got in there? It's not a tea party, it's a circus. That so? He turns on his smile, the goofy one that says he doesn't take himself too seriously, and neither should you. But the back of his hand stings where she smacked him. She glares at him suspiciously, not for who he might be, what he might do to her, but because she is irritated that he doesn't understand. He looks around more carefully and recognizes it now, her ramshackle circus, the big top ring marked out with a finger traced in the dirt, a tightrope made from a flattened drinking straw rigged between 2 soda cans, the Ferris wheel of the dented bicycle wheel, half propped up against a bush, with a rock to hold it in place, and paper people torn out of magazines jammed between the spokes. It doesn't escape him that the rock holding it up is the perfect fit for his fist. Or how easily one of those needle spokes would slide right through the girl's eye like jello. He squeezes hard on the plastic pony in his pocket. The furious buzzing coming from underneath the cup is a vibration he can feel all the way down his vertebra, tugging at his groin. The cup jolts and the girl clamps her hands over it. Whoa! She laughs, breaking the spell. Whoa, indeed, you got a lion in there? He nudges her with his shoulder, and a smile breaks through her scowl, but only a little one. You an animal tamer? You gonna make it jump through flaming hoops? She grins, the polka dots of her freckles drawing up into Dutch apple cheeks, revealing bright white teeth. Nah, Rachel says I'm not allowed to play with matches. Not after last time. She has one skewed canine, slightly overlapping her incisors. And the smile more than makes up for the brackwater brown eyes, because now he can see the spark behind them. It gives him that falling away feeling in his chest. And he's sorry he ever doubted the house. She's the one. One of the ones. His shining girls.
Lauren, you won the UK's top science fiction prize, the Arthur C. Clarke Award, for your novel Zoo City. Why turn to thrillers and murders for The Shining Girls?
Well, I think there was murder in Zoo City and Moxieland as well. I think all of my books have been high-concept thrillers to a certain extent, and this still has science fictional elements. I write the stories which occur to me, and people tell me what they are afterwards. You know, so Moxieland has been described as cyberpunk, Zoo City has been described as urban fantasy, this is apparently a thriller. I'm like, that's great, fantastic, I'm just writing the story I want to write.
Yeah, you've definitely still got the kind of the high concept science fiction twist there with the time-travelling serial killer. He jumps through the decades killing the women that he describes as his shining girls, doesn't he? The women who are making a change in the world, such as the women's rights activists in the 70s. The deaths that you write about are quite brutal and all women. Was it quite hard doing that, and how did you approach it?
Well, I feel very passionately about violence against women. And how we report it in the media and how it's written about in crime fiction and how usually a dead woman is just a dead woman. She's just a body. And I was very interested in getting at who these people were before they were killed. So I've tried to create these real portraits of different characters and to really get into their lives and to find out who they were and what their lives meant and their hopes and dreams and ambitions and goals. And I spend most of the chapter doing that. And then at the end is kind of one brutal detail about the murder, and it's written from their perspective, so you're with them and you feel their fear. So I try to create real portraits of a range of different women, from an architect in the 1950s who's living under McCarthyism to an African-American welder in 1943, and the murders are very much written from their perspective. So the welder, for example, you're with her and she's thinking about her children and how they're going to be able to cope without her, and I'm really trying to get at home at what violence is and what it does to people. And the ripples it sends out, and the fact that her kids are going to lose their mother. And it's not written from the perspective of the killer, where you're almost complicit in the killing and you're kind of riding along with him and you're almost kind of getting off on it.
The torture porn thing.
Exactly. I hate the torture porn thing. I really wanted to avoid that. So yes, the violence is shocking. It's usually hung on 1 or 2 details, and it's usually only a paragraph or 2 maximum. I don't linger on it, but I'm also not going to flinch away from it. Mm. I want you to know that real violence is shocking and horrific, and it's really important to be able to say that.
No, absolutely. I found that the way that you wrote about it was shocking almost because you did it in such an emotionless way. You don't get into the feelings of the killer or anything like that, so you're just describing what's happening. Like when Kirby, the girl who you read about when she was 6 years old, just then, when she's being attacked later in the book by Harper. It's just so clinical the way that you've done it that it really is quite shocking.
It was supposed to be. And also, I mean, Kirby's attack is, she's the survivor. She's the one who survives the attack and turns the hunt around. And I needed you to know what she'd been through and why this has taken over her entire life. And she's become obsessed with finding the man who did this to her and stopping him from doing it to anyone else.
Yeah.
So that is a particularly grueling scene, but it's supposed to be.
Yeah, it probably was. And Harper, the murderer at the centre of the book, his actions are what drives the novel forwards, but he himself is something of a blank, really, in comparison to the women who you flesh out and really bring to life. You don't really go into the reasons why he's such a psychopath.
Well, I did a lot of research on serial killers. Usually listening to true crime podcasts on the treadmill, which is, you don't need a trainer, you just need to listen to podcasts about serial killers and you'll run faster, trust me. But a lot of it is driven by impotence in their real lives or actual sexual dysfunction. And, you know, a lot of them are kind of blank and they're not particularly interesting. They're not these sophisticated Hannibal Lecters of the world. And I was much more interested in the woman with these rich, incredible lives. And, of course, that's partly what he's reacting to as well, is that he can't stand that and he has to cut it out of them.
And Kirby herself, I think, is a fantastic heroine. She's so feisty and tough, but also obviously damaged in both physically and mentally.
A lot of it was based on a really amazing story of a real-life South African survivor called Alison, who was attacked in the 1990s in quite a similar way, and she managed to survive, but she was able to forgive and let go. And everywhere she goes, people recognize her and they know that she's that girl. Mm. And having to live with this and never being able to escape it, it's very, very difficult for her. So
yeah, at one point you have someone who she thinks might become a friend looking at her with awe, or I think that's the word that you use, and she's just like, okay, this isn't going to work. You can't think of me like that.
Exactly.
You know, tell me about the time travel thing. It always messes with my head reading books about time travel. I imagine writing about it is even worse. How do you keep everything in place and under control?
It was really hard, but it was also incredibly important to me that everything made sense and that there aren't any, you know, holes. There are definitely loops and there are paradoxes and there are overlaps, but it's a time travel novel. You should expect that. But everything is absolutely immaculately plotted out. I had a murder wall above my desk tracking the three different timelines with red strings connecting the murders. And the other thing that Harper does is he takes an object from each victim and leaves it on a different victim. For example, he takes a 1993 baseball card from a young Korean woman and leaves it on the body of the African-American welder, Zora, in 1943. So these anachronistic clues through time. But I also had to track where the objects were and where they were going and make sure that absolutely everything worked. And the other thing was that I dealt with Harper, who is such a vile, awful human being. The only way I could deal with writing him was by hurting him at every single opportunity. I broke his jaw, I ripped his Achilles tendon, but then I also had to keep track of his injuries. And, you know, how is his jaw healing? Is it still wired up in this particular scene? Mm-hmm. So it was really tricky to keep track of, but I was lucky to have editors in three different countries all fact-checking immaculately and making sure that everything made sense.
And was it always going to have time travel in right from the beginning?
Yep. I came up with the idea on Twitter. I was actually writing another book at the time, and I threw out the idea that I wanted to write a time-traveling serial killer. And I was like, wait, yes, I really should, because I could do something really interesting with that. Mm-hmm. And not just as a thriller, that I could use it as a way to explore how we've been shaped by the 20th century, how things have changed, how some things absolutely haven't changed. There's a women's rights activist in 1972. The stuff that she's dealing with and a woman's right to control her body, the fact that that is still a relevant issue 50 years later is so depressing. So the things which come up again and again, you know, the Great Depression, the depression we're dealing with now, McCarthyism versus the War on Terror, it was really interesting to kind of pick out these threads of history and look at the resonances with today.
So Zoo City was set in a kind of an alternate version of Johannesburg, and you're South African. Why go for Chicago this time around?
Because I had the idea for a time-traveling serial killer and I knew I wanted to do the 20th century. And in South Africa, that would immediately have become an apartheid story and that would have overshadowed everything else that I wanted to talk about. And I've lived in Chicago, so I felt like I knew it well enough to be able to write about it. And there's some amazing stuff in Chicago. It's, you know, the birth of the skyscraper, incredible modernism. The apartheid government actually went to Chicago, apparently, in the 1950s to learn how to do segregation better. Because it's one of the most racially segregated cities in America. And the way you do it, apparently, is to drive a highway straight through the middle of the slums. You know, obviously, I lived in Chicago, but I went back on a research trip and I interviewed a whole bunch of different people. from Jim DeRogatis, who's a music critic who told me all about the 90s punk scene, but also working at the Chicago Sun-Times with Roger Ebert. I interviewed a Chicago police detective who, you know, we went through old case files. He showed me some old video on actual VHS of, like, crime scenes. And we talked through the logistics of what information Kirby would and would not have had access to.
Your first novel, at least in the UK, sorry, not your second novel, Zoo City, in the UK, was published by a tiny little press. And then this one became the subject of a big bidding war in Frankfurt, and you got signed up by HarperCollins. It's quite a change. What's that all been like?
What's really amazing is to be able to be a full-time writer, to not have to have a day job. Since the auction, I can just write full-time, and that's amazing. I miss journalism, and I miss writing for kids' TV. To be able to afford to be able to go to Chicago. You know, when I won the Arthur C. Clarke Award, I was so broke that my friends had to put together a fundraiser to pay for my £1,000 plane ticket to get me here so I could actually attend the ceremony.
Yeah, you said you've done children's television and journalism, and you've also written comics and screenplays. So what's next?
I have to deliver my new book by the end of the year, which is set in Detroit, and that's called Broken Monsters. I have to kill more people. I'm so sick of killing people. But it's much more about the detective's relationship with her daughter.
And is there a kind of twist, a science fictional
there
twist?
There is definitely a twist. I think my books will always have some element of the weird about them. But, you know, I think having a high concept like time travel or, you know, in Zoo City, having criminals with magical animals, it's a way of getting over issue fatigue. You know, it's a way of twisting reality in a really interesting way that allows us to explore issues that we're so sick of talking about. It's kind of a refresh on reality.
Lauren Bucas there. I've hoiked Alison back into the studio to talk some more, because you're a bit of an aficionado of this sort of genre writing, aren't you? And there were a couple of things I particularly wanted to ask you about. I was very struck by Lauren's statement that the only way she could deal with Harper Curtis was to hurt him at every opportunity. Is this a normal sort of relationship for an author to have with a character?
It's definitely an interesting approach to take, but it's true, her killer does get put through the mill. I'm not sure it's that unusual. It probably comes with a job a bit, I would say, for a serial killer to get fairly injured going about their business. But the way that Lauren talks about it, that she had to hurt him in order to be able to write about what he was doing, is intriguing. He obviously feels really real to her, and I think that he really does to the reader as well.
Now, I was also struck by the politics. She obviously feels very strongly about violence against women, and I wondered to what extent this was a political novel.
Well, I think Lauren does make the point that she wanted to make her female victims more than just victims, so each is given a proper slice of life before she meets the end, a family or a career or something which makes her more than just a victim, and that's clearly important to Lauren, as is making sure her serial killer gets his comeuppance at the end. And she's a journalist as well as an author, so she's seen social injustice and violence against women firsthand, so I guess this novel, this fiction, is her way of making sure the good guys can win sometimes.
Do you feel that women are particularly victimised in horror fiction?
Yeah, I think they probably are. If you think of a horror film, for example, you think of women fleeing the serial killer, don't you? And often quite brutal murders of women in novels as well.
There's often a sexual subtext to the whole thing, isn't there?
Yes.
Particularly with vampires, let's say.
Yes, this is true. This is true.
From vampires and back to zombies, which I mentioned at the start of this podcast, it's one of the most successful horror tropes of the moment. It's been particularly huge in fiction for young adults. And one of its most successful proponents is the comedian turned novelist Charlie Higson, who turned up at our children's books website a while back to offer tips in writing the undead. He said a couple of interesting and I think pertinent things. Firstly, his monsters aren't classic zombies because they haven't died and come back to life. He said,
"Nowadays, the term zombie covers a wide range of monsters. I think any mass of sick humans who've turned psychotic can be lumped under the zombie banner. So we can talk about 28 Days Later as a zombie film, even though the director Danny Boyle calls his monsters the infected."
The other thing he said, and it struck me that this is possibly relevant to The Shining Girls too, is it's not really about zombies, you know.
The best zombie stories are not really about The Walking Dead at all. The best zombie stories use zombies as a metaphor. Zombies are human, after all. Put a load of zombies in a shopping mall, and you've got a satire on our mindless consumer society. Put them in the Houses of Parliament, and you've got a satire on politics and politicians. Set the army on them, and you've got a satire on war and the military. Put them in the church, and you've got a satire on the followers of organised religion. Over the years, zombie films have been about a lot of things. The Vietnam War, racism, communism, vegetarianism, AIDS. Zombie stories can be a good way to write about something else important that interests you. My own books are about children's fear of adults, and also ask questions about the best way to set up and run a civilised society. Just make sure you put a lot of spilled guts in there as well.
Thank you, Charlie, or at least your stand-in. If you'd like to find out more about creating your own undead, you can find Charlie's advice on guardian.co.uk/children's books. It's certainly true that we don't often do horror fiction on this books podcast. We're timid souls, you see. But that doesn't mean it's without its own history, dynasties even, and none grander than that of Stephen King, who, incidentally, had his own first brush with zombies in his 1989 short story, Home Delivery. King's son, Joseph, has now followed his dad into the horror business, though he's very much his own man, so much so that his approach to name-dropping was to, well, drop the name. Yes, he writes under the name of Plain Joe Hill, as he told Alison when he came in to talk about his new novel, Nosferatu. That's N-O-S-4-R-2, as in a car number plate. Hill's serial killer, Charlie Manx, drives around in a Rolls-Royce Silver Wraith, you see.
I always wanted to be a writer, going back to when I was just, 12, 13. But when I was in college, I determined that my last name wouldn't really do me any favors. I had this fear that if I started writing work as Joseph King, a publisher would see a chance to make a quick buck in the last name and would be willing to publish mediocre work. And I felt that that wouldn't be doing me a whole lot of good because readers are smart and they might buy your first book because you got a famous daddy. But if it's no good, they won't buy the second one. And I wanted to have a long career. So I dropped the last name. I began writing as Joe Hill. And I was able to keep it a secret about my parents for about 10 years. And in that time, I wrote a whole mess of short stories, some of which were published, most of which weren't. I wrote 3 novels that I was never able to sell. And I had a chance to develop my craft and make my mistakes in private, which is where they belong, and gradually get over some insecurities. And I think that that was really the important thing is when I sold work, I needed to know for myself that it sold for the right reasons, that it sold because an editor was excited about the work in question, not because they were excited about some aspect of my parentage. So eventually, I had 15 short stories that I thought were pretty good. I was unable to sell them to any publisher in America or any of the big publishers in England, but a small English press called PS Publishing decided to take a chance on the collection. The publisher there, Peter Crowther, also writes short stories that are weird and strange. He's something of a kindred spirit. He liked what he saw in my fiction, and he bought that collection. And then later, on the good buzz around the collection, I was able to sell my first novel, Heart-Shaped Box. Before that book came out, things deteriorated, and my pen name kind of came apart like tissue in the rain. But by then, it didn't really matter because I had already accomplished some things I needed to accomplish for myself. I had managed to sell some stories and develop creatively and become a little more confident.
The two novels that you published prior to Nosferatu, Heart-Shaped Box and Horns, were both horror novels. But with this one, it really feels like you've thrown off any worries about being compared to your father. I mean, you even make references to his work. It's the only other novel I can think of that's got a scary car in it other than Christine. Yeah. Is that deliberate?
Yeah, Nosferatu is a story about a man who has a car that runs on human souls instead of gasoline. And it does have a lot of Stephen King tropes and motifs in it. You know, in some ways, Nosferatu is my senior thesis on horror fiction, and it's impossible to talk about modern horror fiction without referring to Stephen King. Also, I had spent a lot of the early part of my career, even though I was writing genre fiction, even though I was writing scary stuff, avoiding overt references to my father's work, because it felt important to me to sort of carve out a literary space of my own. But I don't know, I'm 40. and I've had a lot of things I wanted, and it felt like, you know, I'm very proud of my dad's work. You know, he's one of my best friends, and we talk every day, and I wanted to write a book that honored that in some ways and dealt with that in some ways instead of constantly ducking it. You know, and also, it's tough for me to stay serious for very long, and so there's a lot of Stephen King goofing off in the book, and a lot of goofing off with a lot of my other geek fascinations, whether it's Firefly or the novels of David Mitchell, or have my little geek tomfoolery in there.
Amongst all the scares.
So, this is from the beginning of Nosferatu, and we're in a prison hospital with a nurse named Ellen Thornton. In all the time she'd been working at FCI Englewood, in the Supermax prison infirmary, Ellen had never seen Charlie Manx with his eyes open. She'd been on staff for 3 years, and he had been comatose all that time. He was the frailest of her patients, a fragile coat of skin with bones inside. His heart monitor blipped like a metronome set to the slowest possible speed. The doc said he had as much brain activity as a can of creamed corn. No one had ever determined his age, but he looked older than Keith Richards. He even looked a little like Keith Richards. A bald Keith, with a mouthful of sharp little brown teeth. There were 3 other coma patients in the ward, what the staff called gorks. When you were around them long enough, you learned that all the gorks had their quirks. Don Henry, a man who burned his girl and her kids to death, went for walks sometimes. He didn't get up, of course, but his feet pedaled weakly under the sheets. There was a guy named Leonard Potts who'd been in a coma for 5 years and was never going to wake up. Another prisoner had jammed a screwdriver through his skull and into his brain. But sometimes he cleared his throat and would shout, "I know!" as if he were a small child who wanted to answer the teacher's question. Maybe opening his eyes was Manx's quirk, and she'd just never caught him doing it before. "Hello, Mr. Manx," Ellen said automatically. "How are you feeling today?" She smiled a meaningless smile and hesitated, still holding the sack of body temperature blood. She didn't expect a reply, but thought it would be considerate to give him a moment to collect his non-existent thoughts. When he didn't say anything, she reached forward with one hand to slide his eyelids closed. He caught her wrist. She screamed, couldn't help it, and dropped the bag of blood. It hit the floor and exploded in a crimson gush, the hot spray drenching her feet. "Ah!" she cried. "Ah! Oh, God!" It smelled like fresh-poured iron. "Your boy, Josiah," Charlie Manx said to her, his voice grating and harsh. "There's a place for him in Christmas Land, with the other children. I could give him a new life. I could give him a nice new smile. I could give him nice new teeth."
Yeah, I really loved your feisty tattooed heroine, Vic. And I was terrified by Charlie Manx, your villain, and also by the children that he abducts and he turns into something even scarier than himself. I wanted to know a bit about the origins of the story. Is Charlie a sort of spiritual vampire, and is this your take on all of the vampire literature?
So Charlie has this car, a 1938 Rolls-Royce, and he takes kids into the car and takes them on a long trip. And over the course of this trip, he drains something essential from them, some element of their spirit. And it keeps him young, and it keeps him fit and strong. And he survived for over a century devouring this essence from children. And when he's done with them, they're very monstrous. You know, they have this terrific sense of fun, but no empathy anymore. They have, you know, rows of teeth, and they like to use them to sink them into things. And he dumps them in this nightmarish amusement park called Christmas Land, where every morning is Christmas morning, and every night is Christmas Eve. You know, if you asked Charlie, he would say, "I saved these kids. I protected them from all the harm the world can do to them. And I think that is interesting to explore. It's easy to make a villain who is the captain of evil, you know, who is Mr. Evil. But most people don't think of themselves that way. You know, even people who do very terrible things, they will say to you, I had to. Every terrible thing I did was in the name of a good cause. You know, and Charlie is just so deranged that he can't see that what he's doing is monstrous.
How do you set about writing something scary?
When horror works because it creates a feeling of empathy. You give readers characters who seem emotionally real, people who have an interesting inner lives, people who have regrets, a history, ambitions, weird fixations, and then you take these characters and you put them into a box and you see if they can punch their way out. You know, when horror fails, I think of like the slasher films of the 1980s, Friday the 13th, and I had fun watching those films. They were a good time, but they weren't very good horror. And the reason why is you're given these characters that are just one-dimensional stereotypes. You get the jock, the cheerleader, the geek, the stoner, the good girl. And they're all just bowling pins to be knocked down by Freddy Krueger. The only character who is more than one-dimensional is usually the serial killer. And you wind up laughing at their murders. You know, I find that vaguely morally abhorrent. I don't want to root for the bad guy. I want to root for the good guy, you know? I want to care about people. And so one of the things I try to do is I try to anchor my stories in characters you can really root for. People who seem real and who you would be invested in real life. And then when they're in danger, you're on their side instead of on the side of the killer.
Mm. So what does scare you then?
Oh, it's not a very exciting answer, but I'm a single dad and I have three kids, you know? And you worry about all the terrible things the world can do to them, you know, all the ways they can be hurt. And that's one of the things that Nosferatu is about. The monster in the closet is scary. The hobgoblin under the bed is frightening. But being a parent is really scary, much scarier. You know, the world is full of sharp edges, and it's your job as a parent to get between your children and all those blades and prevent them from being scarred. But you can't fully protect them. To some degree, they're on their own. Every day is a new chance to mess up. And I wanted to explore that some in the
book.
And
Vic, your heroine, her own son, gets in trouble with Charlie.
Yeah, well, so Vic has crossed Manx once. So Charlie has this impossible ride. He has his Rolls-Royce Wraith. Vic also has a reality-bending ride, her Triumph Bonneville motorcycle. Charlie Manx uses his vehicle to destroy lives. Vic uses her ride to save them. Unsurprisingly, the two of them find each other in conflict over 25 years and thousands of miles of road. Vic has crossed Manx more than once, and he decides it's time for a little revenge. And when she's a young mother, he comes for her son and captures Wayne, her child, and then it becomes a race to see if she can save Wayne from Charlie Manx before Charlie gets to Christmas Land and finishes off everything that's good in her kid. And I do think that in everyday life, there are things which are hard to deal with, ideas which are frightening, like what would it be like to suffer and die? What would it be like if something terrible happened to my kid? These are things we have a hard time dealing with, but in the safe playground of fiction, we can explore them and we can rehearse for the worst and we can think about our own reactions and we can learn without actually going through these terrific traumatic experiences.
Did you always know that you wanted to write horror, or did you start out with more mainstream novels?
So when I was in college, I did do this thing where I dropped my last name and started writing under the pen name. And the other thing I did at that time was I felt, I'm not going to write genre fiction. I'm going to write literary stories, the kind of stuff that's getting published in The New Yorker. The pen name stuck, but that decision to write New Yorker-style fiction didn't. I spent about 2 years writing stories about divorce and adultery and unhappy children dealing with mentally disturbed parents. And those stories kind of put my soul to sleep. They didn't excite me. And I sent them to editors who would say the same thing. They would say, we admire your technical ability, but these stories don't excite us. There was something missing. And then a couple years in, I wrote a short story called Pop Art about the friendship between a juvenile delinquent and an inflatable boy, a kid named Arthur Roth who's made of plastic and filled with air. He weighs 6 ounces, and if he sat in a sharpened pencil, it would kill him. And I just had so much fun writing that story. I had such a terrific time. It was this huge leap into fantasy. And I had this realization that writing as Joe Hill, there was no reason anyone would connect me to my dad. And, if I wanted to write horror fiction as stories of weird fantasy, I could. That would be safe. And so I did, and I found out it was terrific fun. I think if I'd been writing as Joseph King, I would have been afraid to write those kind of stories because I would have thought the comparison would be, too overwhelming.
But why horror? I mean, do you just enjoy...
Well, when I was growing up, when I was 12, 13, 14, other kids my age had posters on their walls of athletes or rock stars. All the posters on my wall were torn out of the pages of Fangoria magazine, which was this horror magazine dedicated to the work of gross-out special effects artists, Tom Savini, Rob Bottin, Stan Winston. I loved those movies. I loved those creators. I think my first ambition was really to be a special effects guy, not to be a writer. Also, the writers I cared most about, not counting my mom and dad, the writers I cared most about when I was in my teens were comic book writers, Neil Gaiman and Alan Moore, who both wrote stories of the strange and the surreal. Neil Gaiman wrote a groundbreaking series called Sandman, and Alan Moore, who's most famous for Watchmen, had a terrific run on a comic called Swamp Thing about a pile of talking moss. I loved those stories, which were very scary and adult, and played with all kinds of weird fantasy elements, and really wanted to write that sort of fiction. So I think it's unsurprisingly that's the direction I moved in as an adult.
Do you think that horror is growing in popularity these days?
I think we're going through a good period for horror. Horror is a pendulum that swings between, its moments of clarity and power and moments when it's just disappointing and exploitive. In the 80s, there were the slasher films, which I had some fun with some of those movies, but they're pretty shallow. In the late 90s and early 00s, we had a whole rash of torture porn films, which I just thought were kind of seedy and disgusting. But at the moment, we're going through a great period. We have films like Woman in Black and Mama. We've had terrific novels that have played with horror tropes, whether it's Justin Cronin's work or the stuff that Neil Gaiman has done. You have all these literary writers like Jonathan Lethem and Michael Chabon playing with fantasy and science fiction and horror elements. And so I do think this is a terrific time for the genre where we're seeing a lot of adult, mature, smart, character-driven work. Cabin in the Woods, Joss Whedon's work was so entertaining and did so much to explode the cliches of the slasher film. Horror is rightfully popular because there's some great work in the genre right now.
Well, that's one of those things you don't want to say in the wrong context, isn't it? That we're going through a good period for horror. But Alison, there's an important point he's making, which is that it is very popular at the moment. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that horror has been growing bigger and bigger in the cinemas over the years, and it's crossing over into books now too. It kind of feels less geeky, it feels less focused on a male readership than maybe it has done in the past.
So the readership is growing up?
Yes, I think so.
Has the distinction between thriller and horror gone now? I know it's notable that both Joe Hill and Lauren Bukis seem to combine them quite happily.
Yeah, it's one of those distinctions which are really important to booksellers and publishers, but which I wonder how much readers actually care about. Thrillers are naturally going to be fairly horrific. They deal with death and murder and the hunt for a killer. And horror novels, meanwhile, are going to be pretty thrilling. But I do think you're right that Nosferatu and The Shining Girls are good examples of books which combine the two genres. I definitely found Hill's novel so thrilling I couldn't put it down and I raced to the end. And The Shining Girls was at times almost too horrific to read. So I think if we had to pin down the two genres, could we maybe say that thrillers deal with real-world horror and horror novels with supernatural or paranormal horror?
Is this what Lauren Bukis was talking about when she talked about high concept?
Well, yes, she gives her thriller a high concept twist. She gives it the time travel element, which she says she does to sort of make it fresh, bring a fresh twist to the genre. It makes her serial killer even harder to catch, and it gives her the excuse to explore these different eras for sure.
We talk a lot about psychological thrillers. Do you think we need to invent a new genre on this podcast, like the psychological horror, shall we say?
I think that could work well, yes. It's sort of meaning steering clear of the gore and the slasher killers of horror novels of the past and just truly terrifying novels, for example.
And Joe Hill says we've gone past that anyway. Do you think that's true?
I think so. There's a novel, horror novel I read years ago called Slugs by Sean Hudson about killer demon slugs, which has stayed with me ever since. I think we're long past that when it comes to horror. Joe Hill is certainly a lot more sophisticated.
Now, thrillers and crime have emerged from the genre ghetto pretty completely, thanks to writers like Ian Rankin, John le Carré, and more recently, Gillian Flynn. Do you think that horror is becoming respectable in that way?
In some respects, I think it probably is. There's kind of literary authors dabbling in it, some through the new Hammer Horror imprint, like Jeanette Winterson and Julie Myerson and Helen Dunmore. So this is proper established writers who have been asked to write a story with a horrific twist to it. And there's also prize-winning authors like Chase Novak, who wrote a horrific novel set in New York called Breed last year. John Boyne, the boy in the striped pyjamas, has just published This House is Haunted, which is a terrifying ghost story. And there was Colson Whitehead, who wrote the zombie novel, which was out a couple of years ago.
Now, there's a difference between... Ghost stories aren't necessarily all horror. In fact, Helen Dunmore got into trouble with The Overcoat, which was her Hammer Horror title, for not being horrific enough, which I thought was very unfair, because that wasn't really what she was doing.
Yeah, so can a ghost story count as a horror novel? Does it depend on how much it scares you? I mean, Women in Black, for example, made me completely jump out of my skin, and I would call that a horror novel in some respects, just because it is so terrifying. But they are a long way from the classic horror, which we've said anyway, that we think we're moving away from.
Now, these are literary writers slumming it. How literary is the writing of Bukis and Joe Hill?
I would say it's not really about penning the perfect sentence or beautiful descriptions, anything like that. But that's not really what I'm judging it on. I'm more judging it on how much they want to keep me reading. They never jar you out of the world that they've created. I think they write really well, but they're not trying to write a literary novel. They're trying to write a page-turning great read that carries you zooming through to the end.
So, for example, you might expect the sentences to be shorter. They're not going to have lots of florid sub-clauses, are they?
No, or shorter chapters just to keep you moving on. Lots of cliffhangers.
But they have a quality all of their own. I think it's that's something that doesn't get said often enough, that actually
they're trying to do something different. It's not trying to be a beautifully written literary novel about... Well, I think Joe Hill says it in the interview that he started out trying to write literary novels about divorcing parents and that kind of thing, and he just couldn't do it. He just wanted to write a bloody scary book, and that's what he ended up doing.
Well, plenty to get your teeth into there. Joe Hill's Nosferatu is published by Galanx, and Lauren Bukis' The Shining Girl by HarperCollins. You'll have to wait till September to get your claws on the fifth book in Charlie Higson's The Enemy series of zombie novels. Thanks to Alison, to Joe Hill and Lauren Bukis. I'm Claire Armistead. From me and our producer, Tim Mabey, goodbye.
Visit audible.co.uk/Guardian Audio to choose from a selection of over 60,000 titles. With Audible, you can make more time for books by downloading and listening wherever you are and whatever you're doing.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.